Let's call this December Land Board meeting to order. I'm sure you've all had the opportunity to review minutes. Is there a motion?
Governor, I move approval of the minutes.
Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? The motion passes. Let's go to our first action item. That's cool.
Land Board members, the first action item is Montana Heritage Commission, Johnson Land Donation. We do have staff representing the commission to present.
Governor Bullock, State Land Board representatives, my name is Elijah Allen. I am the director of the Montana Heritage Commission that oversees Virginia and Nevada City, which is Montana's number one state-owned tourist destination. This generous land donation comes from the Evelyn Johnson family and is donating 7 acres to the Montana Heritage Commission, State of Montana, that appraised for $92,000. The primary reason is that the State of Montana has a steam locomotive and train that travels through this property, and we're finishing up with a lease agreement where the State of Montana was paying easement expenses of close to $5,000 per year. All due diligence and public hearings have been completed with no opposition. It is the unanimous opinion of the 14-member Montana Heritage Commission Board, the Town of Virginia City, and Madison County Commissioners that you accept this generous donation to the State of Montana. With that, I will be available for any questions or comments.
Thanks, Elijah. Is there any public comment? Any public comment? Is there a motion?
Governor, I move approval of item 1217-1.
Is there a second?
Second.
Questions or comments? Questions or comments?
Just, I guess, although the donor is not here, it's, I think, worthy of, in the record, saying thank you for such a wonderful donation that really helps tie up the state's heritage properties in the area. And it's a wonderful gift in the Christmas season to be able to consider this. So perhaps the staff might put together a thank you note for the Land Board commissioners to sign personally to the donor. That would be great.
Will do. And I'd also just, as all of you as members of the commission and elected officials, if you haven't had the opportunity to spend a little bit of time in Virginia City, call Elijah, because he really is the keeper to the keys, and I know that both I and my family have really enjoyed it at times. So. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion passes. Thanks so much. Next action item.
Governor, there's three timber sales. Number one, or A, 2A, is Henderson Hill in Mineral County. Benefits public buildings, estimated value $264,000. 13 miles west of St. Regis, Montana, 5 harvest units, 2.6 million board feet. It's a harvest prescription of individual trees with pine beetle kill that they're going to improve the stand. Access is through the Lolo National Forest. We recommend the Henderson Hill timber sale. The second timber sale is 2B, Lolo Peak Salvage. This is associated with the Lolo Peak fire this last summer. Missoula and Ravalli County, Common Schools. Minimum bid is $36,445. 2 miles southeast of Lolo and Florence, Montana. 10 harvest units, 2.2 million board feet. It is, again, a salvage, single tree selection. Number of commenters that we believe we've addressed their issues. And then finally, the Tornilla Creek in Sanders County, Common Schools. Minimum bid estimated to be $317,688. It's 36 miles north of Plains, 2.8 million board feet of saw logs. The sale has a seed tree and shelterwood harvest prescription. Again, public comment was received, and we believe we've addressed it. We recommend the three timber sales for approval.
Any public comment? Is there a motion?
Governor, I would move we approve the timber sales described under 1217-2.
Is there a second? Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion passes. Next action item, please.
Item 3 is the oil and gas lease sale on December 5th. We sold leases in Bighorn, Garfield, Glacier, Powder, Richland, Roosevelt, Sweetgrass, and Toole Counties, Common School, MSU Moral Trust, Public Land Trust for Navigable Rivers. Total revenues, $194,406, which is good, not as high as last. Interesting of note is we got some value out of Bighorn County as the probably the big winners in the sale. We recommend approval.
Any public comment on the oil and gas lease sale? Is there a motion?
Governor, I would move that we approve the oil and gas lease sale from December 5th as described under 1217-3.
Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion?
Governor, I would just comment that the director seemed surprised that there would be such value coming out of my home county, of Bighorn County, and I was not surprised at all. In fact, those numbers seemed to me to be a little low.
I was trying to be complimentary. Sure. I apologize, Chairman.
Like oil, aged things came out of that place, huh? Any additional questions or comments? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Next item.
Item 4 is a report on the biennial cabin site lease program and its rate review. This is the cabin site leases, not the sales program. In the Montrass 3 settlement, the department set forth a set of new policies that we then are obligated to review, do an economic analysis, report to the board, and then next meeting we'll have an action item. Given the complexity of the report, I will let you consume it for a month, and then we'll have an action item next year in January. The cabin site lease sales, we started program basically works where a vacant lot is, we offer it at 6.5% for 60 days. It may be reduced to 5% for an additional 60 days. If it is within a neighborhood of high vacancy, over 30%, we can reduce that rate. We have yet to reduce below 4%. Sean Thomas is here to present more details.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning, Governor, members of the Land Board. For the record, Sean Thomas, Trust Lands Division Administrator, DNRC. I just would, I guess, refer you to the beyond the agenda item itself and to the economic report on page 3 of 11. If you look at the bottom of that page on table 1, I think what we've done here since the settlement agreement is we have released the bidding periods that are identified there, June through August of 2016, where we started off with all of the available cabin site leases unless we withheld specific ones for specific reasons at 6.5%. You'll see that when we put those 76 lots out, we received 6 bids that averaged 7%. Then from August to October of that year, we reduced it to 5 as per the settlement agreement. 63 went out, 2 were received, so on and so forth. You will see that in June of July of 17, we did have quite a few more bids as the market's gotten improved. One of the conclusions the economist draws here is that, one, housing markets have improved and recreational property values have improved, and two, there's some stability now because of the settlement agreement in the cabin site leasing program. We think a combination of those two things has shown some increased interest in leasing these properties. I would refer to some of the high vacancy neighborhoods. And so one of the concepts that we developed the settlement agreement with, we sort of categorized these properties into what we called neighborhoods. And we had been sort of informally referring to neighborhoods such as Echo Lake as a neighborhood, McGregor Lake as a neighborhood. And every neighborhood is a little different in terms of the land values, the demand, and whatnot that exists there. So we've categorized into neighborhoods to track the vacancies by neighborhood. We still have several neighborhoods that have a relatively high vacancy rates. And as you read through all this information over the next month, if you have any questions, we're happy to sit down and go through them. But the long and the short of it is, we only have about this 1 year's period of information. We have seen increasing success as we've gone forward. We also have the sale program sort of working in conjunction with this leasing program. So some of the high value or high vacancy areas, such as McGregor Lake, for example, still has a vacancy rate about maybe 40%. We have several properties there that we are going to actually sell rather than release. So we've held them out so that the vacancy rates are not necessarily maybe indicative of what the actual demand is. So there's a variety of factors such as that. We've held an occasional lot or two out for other reasons. Maybe we had a lot line survey issue or an access issue or a variety of those sorts of things. So as we've gone forward and trying to refine this program and get it accurate and correct to either release or sell with proper title and encumbrances all identified and in place, we've tried to do that. So for now, I think our recommendation is to continue on and see how things go over the course of the next period and bring this back for another review with a full 2 years of data 2 years from now. But again, as you review through this information, it's a lot of data. It's fairly complicated how we ended up where we're at and how the process is working, but it is probably the most stable process that we've had since I've been around in this position. With that, I'm available if you have any other questions.
Thanks, Sean. Any board members have questions? Connor Rosendale.
Governor.
Public comment first? Public comment. I guess I should do, sorry. Any public comment? Please, Governor Rosendale.
Okay. Thank you, Governor. Just comment, really. I really appreciate the way that you've gone through and you make an adjustment for have the ability to reduce that offering based upon the vacancy rates and how long that this properties are being offered out there. And I also appreciate that you're taking the vacancy rate where some sales are taking place and recognizing that percentage might be askew. So you're really, this information is gathering is trying to put it in a true, establish what the marketplace really is. And I do appreciate the time and effort that's been taken to do that. Thank you.
Other questions or comments? Questions or comments? Very good. You'll see that back on the agenda in January as an action item. Let's go to the next action item, easements.
We have a number of easements from Northwestern, one new utility that they're bringing in, City of Shelby, Triangle Telephone, a new outfall structure, and the Mid River's telephone. We recommend approval of easements.
Any public comment? Public comment. Is there a motion?
Governor, I move approval of the easements in item 1217-5.
Is there a second?
Second.
Discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? Motion passes. Next action item.
Today we have Amy Gannon, our entomologist, to present a forest insect disease update for State Grasslands Forests.
And I will tell you, for those of you that are new to the board, that nothing is better than an informational update from our state entomologist.
That's been bugging you, huh?
Yeah.
That's
had to do that.
Never gets old, does it?
Okay.
It does.
Good.
All right, great. Thank you. Good morning, Governor and Land Board. I'm Amy Gannon with the DNRC Forest Pest Management Program, and I'm going to give the annual update of insects and diseases across Montana forests. I have to say, though, that the data is not quite ready yet. They just finished flying and doing the aerial survey, so this is all preliminary data, but it's pretty close to accurate. So I'll go through that and just give you a quick update and mention a couple highlights. So first of all, I'd like to talk about common forest insects. This is just sort of a euphemism for insects I talk to you about every single year. You know them, Doug fir beetle, mountain pine beetle, western spruce budworms. These are the ones that we usually talk about as highlights. In the past years, we've had a tremendous mountain pine beetle outbreak. But as you can see from the acres, 37,000 acres this year alone were detected, which is quite insignificant. Most of those are down the Big Hole, and some of it's in the high elevation forest as well. But generally speaking, mountain pine beetle, I can say that we're over the outbreak. Douglas fir beetle also similarly is only down to 37,000 acres or so. This one is also down at background levels, although I am concerned about Douglas fir beetle because it is closely linked with fire activity, and fire-scorched trees can really breed a lot of Douglas fir beetle. So I'll speak about that again, but Douglas fir beetle is not on the rise right now, but we may see it again soon. Spruce budworm does not kill trees. It just defoliates them. We have about 300,000 acres mapped right now. It comes and goes. It can stress trees, and despite its name, it doesn't hit just spruce. It can hit Douglas fir, large grand fir as well. But we're only seeing about 300,000 acres right now, so we're not expecting much in the way of mortality. We are seeing an uptick in grand fir mortality. The picture that's in the upper right corner, that's a picture of an aerial detection survey map. I know it's small. It's not meant for you to see all the details, but just in general, this is how maps look that are in the conditions report. There will be a comprehensive conditions report of all the data collected in 2017. It's collected on the county level, and there are maps for all of these insects that will be in there. In general, the blue dots on this map are more grand fir mortality. We're seeing a lot more than we ever have, have in recent times, and it's over 100,000 acres that have been surveyed, and many more acres have been visited, particularly on private lands. We're seeing quite a bit of mortality. It's linked to drought. It's also linked to root disease. There's a number of beetle species that are involved in this as well. It's not just one bark beetle. So after the fires, we anticipate quite a bit of mortality. Trustlands foresters are already preparing for this. When trees get fire scorched, they may not die, but they become susceptible to bark beetles, and a lot of bark beetles will come in and kill the trees afterwards. Beetles such as red turpentine beetle, western pine beetle, Douglas fir beetle, and then pine engravers. The picture down here, it's a red tree next to a slash pile. Trustlands foresters are pretty familiar with this. These are trees that are killed by an insect also called ips. But we're expecting a lot more mortality. You guys have already talked about salvage sales just from salvaging fire-killed trees. A lot of times after the fire, 2 to 3 years, we'll see a lot of mortality from these other insects. They inhabit the dead trees. Their populations build up to such enormous numbers. Then they spread and they kill seemingly healthy trees. We saw that in 2000 after the fires. We had a tremendous uptick in Doug fir beetle activity. So we're preparing for that now. And it may not happen, but it's good to be prepared in case it does. Root disease is, as ever, playing a big role on the landscape. I talked about how it's killing some of the true fir species. The root disease species that we have typically hit mostly grand fir, Doug fir. Those are the big species that they take out. Here's a picture in spruce. That whole center is rotted out. That's tomentosis. That was actually on a wreck site. You don't want a tree like that. With only a tiny rim of hard wood near it, near tents. It's not a good combination. So Jumping Creek, for example, that Forest and Focus project, that was to address tomentosis root disease. That's a giant armillaria fan. That's common on our landscapes. Trustlands foresters typically know what to do when they see this. They're really adept at identifying it, and the typical prescription is to shift the species composition. So I mentioned that it mostly hits grand fir and Doug fir, so typically what they'll do is cut most of that out and then replant with resistant species such as ponderosa pine and larch. It's a disease of the site. It stays there forever. Even fires, all these fires we've had, didn't go down deep enough into the soils to kill any of these root disease. So once root disease is on a site, it's there for hundreds of years. And there are many different species in Montana. We talk about root disease as a whole, and sometimes in salvage operations or trust operations, they'll just talk about root disease generally, but there are quite a few different species. The most common one is armillaria, and you can see where it's distributed. And then there are a few other ones, and there's also tomentosis that's on this as well, and that's also in the central part of the state. So you may see root disease by different species. Whitebark pine is not typically a timber species. I say not typically because there are some stands on the Swan and the Stillwater State Forest that actually do have whitebark that is of timber form. Whitebark pine is really in decline throughout its host range, and there's a few reasons for that. There's mountain pine beetle. Fire suppression makes it difficult for it to regenerate. It needs bare mineral soil and no competition. So in really dense stands, it can't regenerate. There's also a non-native invasive blister rust, white pine blister rust. It makes this really pretty diamond shape, really clear canker. And white bark pine, you know, from a timber perspective, we may not necessarily care about it, but it's a really important part of the high elevation ecosystem, and it's really important in the upper watersheds because it holds on to snowpack and it regulates runoff. It's also pretty important grizzly bear habitat and wolverine habitat as well. But when we talk about drought and water availability, white bark pine is pretty critical in that whole ecosystem and water cycle. Similarly, limber pine, they're really closely related. Actually, it's really difficult to tell them apart, except for where they grow differently. They can grow in a variety of habitats. Here, they can be in the upper alpine ecosystem, or they can be out in, like, savannas on the east side of the divide. Typically, it grows on the east side of the divide, although there are some spots on the west side in the southern part of the state that they grow. This is truly a non-timber species, but it is important cover for game species and also for wildlife, and it's also susceptible to a white pine blister rust. We're a little bit uncertain about how much it's dying. There's been a lot of questions about that, again, because it's important with water retention as well and hydrology of a site. So there's a pretty large-scale survey that's happening along the Rocky Mountain front, and it's multi-agency, Bureau of Land Management, Forest Service, the Nature Conservancy, and the DNRC are doing an intense survey to look and figure out to what extent it's actually dying. And this is my final slide. This is for those of you in the audience who can't see. It's a white bark pine seedling that's growing, and these are bred to be resistant to white pine blister rust, so it's a little omen of hope at the end of this. But if there's any questions, I'd be happy to take them now.
Amy, a couple questions first. On your first slide, pine beetle at 37,500 and Doug fir. Just for context, what's been a bad year in the past?
Oh, over 1 million acres.
Yep. And as you think forward over the next couple of years, what sort of keeps you up at night, or what sort of concerns should we have?
Non-native invasive species is what keeps me up at night. So I work quite a bit with the Invasive Species Council, and we spend a lot of time talking about what could come in on firewood, and we spend a lot of time looking at firewood. You know, there's Cyrex wood wasp, which does really well in pine. Could it come into Montana and have a heyday? It's had quite an impact in pine forests in New Zealand and Argentina, and it's in the state of New York. So those are the things that keep me up at night. Fortunately, the Invasive Species Council has created a subcommittee to address firewood, and so we're focusing on that. And they're also thinking about creating a subcommittee just to address tree pests alone. There's been a lot of focus on aquatic invasives, which is warranted, but there's a whole facet of tree pests that is a concern as well.
Right. Other questions for Amy?
So I'm curious, what does the state do, if anything, to combat, in particular, these three problems? Nothing, or just...
Yeah, so what does the state do to combat these problems? It depends on the insect itself. So with Douglas fir beetle, for example, a lot of trust lands managers are looking for trees that are scorched or really large trees. Douglas fir beetle prefers trees that are weakened by drought, overstocking, fire scorch. And so those can be marked in for timber sales to be removed so that the populations don't build up. You can actually do some trapping. There's going to be some trapping for Douglas fir beetle on the Swan State Forest, so you can trap out in some spots as well. With mountain pine beetle, there's a lot of management that was done, especially during the outbreak, the peak of the outbreak. That's a more aggressive beetle. It doesn't necessarily hit trees that are weakened, but thinning the stand, creating a different microclimate for the stand can really deter the beetles. You can go after trees where the beetles are grown, or where they're growing. They're called brood trees, and you can remove them, get them to a mill, hopefully, and stem the outbreak a little bit that way. But opening up the stand and creating a change in the microclimate, increasing the wind that goes through a stand is actually really valuable. The insects communicate through chemical messages. If you open the stand, they can't communicate, so they can't find a mate, they can't attack a tree, etc. So there are quite a few different things to do. Spruce budworm, you can thin a stand. You'll still get a lot of defoliation. But once this defoliation subsides, the residual trees will be able to rebound after the defoliation subsides. But a lot of times we like to joke that we don't have an outbreak of spruce budworm. We have an outbreak of Doug fir. So Doug fir often is growing up in areas where it's really shady. And my prescription often is to go in and get rid of that understory Doug fir. So spruce budworm isn't always a negative thing because it can go in and kill that understory.
Thanks for what you do. Appreciate it.
Ed.
Thank you, Governor. Amy, DNRC has demonstrated the rapid response team, if you will, and done a tremendous job. And going back into these areas where we've had severe fires and turned around these salvage sales really quick, as demonstrated by the Lolo fires this year. So my question is, do you have any interaction with the Forest Service? Because lots of times our property has not been burned or damaged, and yet we're contiguous to these federal properties that have suffered these tremendous fires as well. And if all that vegetation has been compromised and it's going to allow these insect problems, and we're right next door, I've got to believe that there's going to be some type of problem that it presents to the state trust lands.
Exactly. And so we do work quite a bit with the Forest Service. I actually don't work on federal lands. There's a group called Forest Health Protection, and they have entomologists and pathologists with whom I work very closely, and they go out and help with the prescriptions. As we all know, the state can be quite nimble when responding to insect and disease outbreaks, and a lot of times when we do have a shared boundary, I will often work with their entomologists and pathologists as well.
What's the sort of dark, hairy moss stuff that grows on some trees, kind of hangs down, and is it dangerous for the tree? Do you know what I'm talking about? No.
I believe I know what you're talking about. I'm hoping you're talking about a lichen. It's not necessarily dangerous for the tree. There are some plants, parasitic plants, that are dangerous to the trees. They're called dwarf mistletoes. We don't have that in ponderosa pine in Montana. They do have it in Idaho, but we have it in a lot of But the
lichens aren't dangerous.
Lichens are not dangerous. They're
don't eat the berries, though.
Any other questions?
I had a question. Amy, are there any eastern Montana impacts? I notice you're looking mostly at timber, but do you know, in drought, do you worry about locusts, crops versus timber? Any concerns there?
I don't work in agricultural entomology. I do work pretty closely with the Department of Agriculture, who does work, and they do grasshopper surveys, et cetera. But I do work in the forest of eastern Montana, and I know that a lot of times when we think of forest, we think of western Montana, but there are extensive corridors, forested corridors, riparian corridors that are really important in eastern Montana, and there is quite a bit of pine, ponderosa pine, and I do work quite a bit, especially with IPS, can be quite damaging once it gets going in fire-scorched or drought-stricken forests of eastern Montana as well. I have a lot going on. Plus, it's...
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions? Well, thank you for the annual update.
Thank you.
Any additional public comment on items that weren't otherwise on the agenda? Any public comment? With that, I'd entertain a motion to adjourn.
Governor, I move we adjourn.
Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Thanks so much.